Our Voices Project acknowledges and honors that the lands we live, love, grow, work, and learn on are the ancestral homelands of the people of the Onondaga or the Seneca, one of the six nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, along with the Cayuga, who call themselves the Gayukono, the Onondaga, who call themselves the Onondaga, the Oneida, who call themselves Oneutica, the Mohawk, who call themselves Genegahaga, and the Tuscarora, who call themselves Garure. We acknowledge that our society was founded upon exclusions and erasures of many Indigenous peoples through centuries of genocide and forced separation from family, culture, language, and from land, spirit, and mind. We acknowledge this violent history of seizure and displacement that allows us to be on this land not only as a recognition, but as a motivation for change. As filmmakers, we are committed to working to dismantle the ongoing legacies of settler colonialism through truth-telling. We invite you to join us in enacting justice by taking such steps as committing to making a recurring monthly donation to a Native-led organization, such as to Ganondagon State Historic Site in Victor, New York, and or Native Made in Rochester, New York. Visit these organizations and find out how you can volunteer your time and help support Native-led initiatives. Find out how Indigenous peoples are represented in your local school district's curricula and advocate for the historical truth-telling of ancestral land dispossession and genocide and the acknowledgement and celebration of Indigenous contributions, past and present. Learn about the Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women movement, created to advocate for the end of violence against Native women and to bring awareness to the high rates of disappearances and murders of Native people, particularly women and girls. Learn how you can help. Help work towards truth, healing, and justice for the Indian boarding school impacts by contributing to the National Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition.
Hey there, coffee lovers. Do you want to make your morning cup of Joe something special? Let's talk about Joe Bean Coffee, a gem right here in Rochester. I'm Chris Lindstrom, host of the Food About Town podcast and co-founder of Lunchador. I've been a longtime fan of Joe Bean. Kathy, Dina, and the whole team are passionate about their coffee and this city, and it comes through in every cup of Joe Bean coffee that I brew at home. Joe Bean has been a part of Rochester for years, over a decade, building lasting community and a sense of belonging for everyone who loves coffee. Next time you need beans, head over to Joe Bean's Roastery at 565 Blossom Road in Rochester, or shop online at joebeanroasters.com. Even better, subscribe to Joe Bean's Perpetual Joy, and you'll receive freshly roasted beans on your schedule and never be without your favorite coffee. Joe Bean is more than just coffee. It's a community, a commitment, and a cup full of care.
This is Evan Dawson. If you like conversations that take you beyond the headlines, join me on Connections. Every day, we dig into the issues shaping Rochester with the people living them, researching them, even trying to change them. No hot takes, no shouting, most of the time. Just real conversations to keep you involved in your community. Listen to Connections wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, Pod. It is day 10 of Black History Month, and we're continuing our series, giving our flowers to Black directors. I'm your host, Jackie McGriff, and if this is your first time listening or watching, welcome to Representation in Cinema. We talk about the films that center Black, Brown, and Indigenous voices, as well as on the film industry itself. I'm not only your host, but also the founder, director, and co-producer of Our Voices Project, a production company that shares the stories and lived experiences of Black, Brown, and Indigenous peoples through visual storytelling and truth-telling. We are community-engaged filmmakers who firmly believe that you can't center films on these communities without being in community and in solidarity with them. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that subscribe button and the little bell to get notified about new episodes. If you're listening on your preferred podcast platform, hit that follow button, rate us 5 stars, and leave a comment to share your thoughts about any of the things that we bring up in this or any other episodes. Tonight's episode is about Peter Ramsey, the director behind Rise of the Guardians and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. And let's get into some background about Peter Ramsey. Peter Ramsey didn't grow up believing he could be a director. Growing up in Crenshaw, he didn't think making movies was something regular people did. He thought films were made by these extraordinary people. He was someone who instead focused a lot on his drawing. For a long time, he thought he'd be a comic book artist. But then he discovered storyboards. Looking at them, something clicked. These weren't just drawings. They were movies before the movie existed. And for the first time, filmmaking felt reachable. Not a dream job, a craft. Working as a storyboard artist put him in rooms with directors on massive productions. He watched how they spoke to departments, how they shaped tone, how they made decisions under pressure. It became his film school, not theory, but observation. He learned filmmaking by watching filmmakers solve problems. So when he eventually stepped into directing, he didn't approach it like an auteur with a megaphone. He approached it like a collaborator. That shows up clearly in the kinds of stories Ramsey gravitates towards. Stories about belonging, identity, and the emotional interior life of characters navigating worlds bigger than themselves. While he and his co-directors were developing the story for Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, he fell in love with Miles Morales and his family, his parents, his uncle, his environment, and wanted audiences to feel that authenticity. The goal wasn't just to watch a hero succeed, it was also to root for him. Ramsey isn't interested in characters who are powerful because they're perfect. He's interested in characters who are powerful because they're figuring it out. That motivation feels personal. For much of his career, he didn't see himself as a pioneer. Even after becoming the first Black filmmaker to win the Academy Award for Best Animated Feature or the first African-American to direct an animated feature after Rise of the Guardians. To him, the job was simply to do good work and honor the people behind it. The crew, the artists, the hundreds of collaborators animation depends on. That attitude carries into how people describe him on a production. Calm, focused on tone and style, generous with credit. Less a commander, more a conductor. Making sure every piece harmonizes. And maybe that's why his films resonate the way that they do. Peter Ramsey makes stories about finding your place in a world that feels predetermined, because his own path into filmmaking wasn't obvious either. He didn't kick the door down. He discovered the door was unlocked all along. And then he held it open for others. So tonight we're giving Peter Ramsey his flowers. If you haven't already watched his films, we highly recommend that you do so. All right, so. On to Rise of the Guardians and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. And actually, before I move on, there was, as I was doing research for this, there were people who had said that he had done both the Spider-Verse films. And just to make the clarification, it's Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse that he directed. He was the executive producer for Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. So we will just be talking about, or I will just be going over Rise of the Guardians and Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Two incredibly well-made animated films. And so for those of you who don't know, so I'll start with Rise of the Guardians.
Can I throw you off base for a second, Jackie?
Sure.
You mentioned the storyboard stuff and how many directors he worked with.
Yeah.
That list is something else.
He worked with Francis Ford Coppola for the Bram Stoker's Dracula, I know.
Worked with Spielberg multiple times, Spike Jonze, and why am I forgetting the guy who was actually driving those movies as well? Charlie Kaufman. Worked with Roland Emmerich multiple times.
Yeah.
I mean, the list is absolutely crazy. It's Independence Day, Tank Girl, Being Malkovich.
Yeah, Fincher Independence twice. Day like threw me. I was like, you worked on Independence Day? Yeah.
He worked with Fincher twice.
Yeah.
He worked on Fight Club. He worked on Panic Room. Like Spielberg multiple times. Like, this is like just the storyboard artist part is like legendary stuff
for sure.
And then his second unit directing stuff, he worked with John Singleton twice.
Yeah.
As second unit director. I mean, those are like legendary films, Poetic Justice, Higher Learning. And then was second unit director on the terrible Godzilla from 1998, but Tank Girl as well.
Yeah.
But these are movies that are so like important to all these different directors that he was a core part of, not before getting to be in the director's seat. That's we're talking almost, 15 years.
Yeah.
Of 15, 20 years before then.
Yeah. Storyboarding. Like, the way that he describes it in interviews, I mean, he's just like dropping name after name. I mean, think the interviews that I watched, he was talking about having worked with David Fincher and
Spike Jonze.
Yeah. Like, and Francis Ford Coppola, just really just like, because I was just like, because he also talks about like having watched these just masterful films. I mean, Apocalypse Now, you have the Godfather movies, and he just remembers like just being in awe, and that this is why he thought that he couldn't be a director. Or didn't know that it was a career, because he thought like these were just like films that like, kind of like fell out of the sky. And like, there are these incredible directors. Like, how do you even get to that level. And so he, for the longest time, didn't think that it was a possibility for him until he started storyboarding and started learning, you know, how to direct. Basically, I mean, essentially, when you're storyboarding, you're working a lot with a director. And so that's how he learned all the tricks of the trade. And of course, I mean, being a storyboard artist, you know, for what, like 15 years, you learn a lot. And especially when you're talking about the greats, like, you know, these directors have been doing it for a long time and have been doing it well. You know, you take a lot from that. And so it's interesting to me that for so long, you know, he didn't think that he would be able to do it. But then when you watch his films and, you know, and it's, you know, it's the two films, and he's also worked on The Mandalorian, you know, he's done some episodes with that, and he's done a number of other things. But for him to only like have like two films under his belt where he is the director, I mean, yeah, he technically co-directed Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, but even so, like that's to his credit, but they are incredibly made films. And I just, Peter Ramsey, because of course you're listening to the podcast, direct more, please. Like, direct more films, which is why I wanted to, again, center an episode on him, because his story is very fascinating. It resonates with me too, because listening to multiple interviews where he talks about, again, not feeling like he, like it was, filmmaking was at all a career. That's what I thought growing up. I remember the first time I went to go look up a film on IMDb, and it was for the movie Holes. And that film, like, really, I remember that being a film where I looked up, you know, actors and, you know, who was working on the film and stuff, like, for the first time. And ever since then, like, I had been doing that since and just figuring out more about it. And I started to work on sets here locally. And I thought that you had, much like he states, like, I thought you had to, like, build, you know, go up the ladder just as far as becoming a director. I didn't know you could just be a director. And yeah, then also too, like, growing up, he also talks about how he's coming from South Central in LA. And back then you didn't have the access to, you know, all the technology that we do now. He also just, he didn't have money to go to film school. Like, he took a few video production classes, which, again, I'm also like, yeah, I took a couple classes in college, but, like, I didn't think that, again, directing was something that I could just do. So that really resonated with me. And then also just to hear him, like, in interviews, like, he's just so, like, humble and, like, down to earth. And it's, and he clearly knows, like, what he's doing. So, again, Peter Ramsey, make more films.
But that he was also 37 his first time as a storyboard artist.
Yeah.
Like, that's, he's not a 23-year-old. He's somebody who'd already lived a life.
Right. Yeah. For
and
sure.
that's a thing. Like, that's, you can thing, you can tell a story better because you've lived. You've lived. You're not out of college. You only have that kind of experience.
Yeah, it wasn't until his 20s where he thought that might be a possibility.
Just cool stuff.
It's cool stuff. But yeah, like, I feel like, you know, when I mention Peter Ramsey, people don't know who I'm talking about. And I'm like, okay, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, you've definitely heard of, right? Well, he was the co-director for that. And Rise of the Guardians, if you haven't watched it, what are you even doing with your life? Speaking of which, Rise of the Guardians. So just a brief synopsis. So this was an animated feature made back in 2012. It follows Immortal's childhood legends. So Santa, or as he's called in the film, North, the Easter Bunny, Tooth Fairy, and Sandy, or the Sandman, who team up with a reluctant new recruit, Jack Frost, voiced by Chris Pine, to stop the evil spirit Pitch Black from destroying children's belief and plunging the world into darkness. So in this film, the Guardians, that's what they call them, that's what they're called. Their mission, their lifelong mission, is to bring joy to children all over the world, to also protect them. And, you know, they have each of them have their duties, right? You know, to the children and everything. And the man in the moon is, like, who they take their direction from. And so they're told, the Guardians are told, you know, they need to, or the man in the moon has found a new recruit. And so that new recruit is Jack Frost. And they, knowing Jack Frost's character, because J- Jack Frost in this film looks like he's a teenager. Like, he looks like a teenager. And so they're like, he's like obnoxious, he's rambunctious, he's arrogant. Like, there's no way that he's the new guardian. And this film, when I saw it back in 2012, I saw it in theaters. I think I went late. I think it was like late at night because I, with a friend, because we were like, we know it's going to be a bunch of kids. Like, if we go in an earlier show.
We don't want none of those kids.
We don't want none of those kids. Like, we just want, we don't want, like, you know, random talking and yelling and stuff like during the film. We were like, okay, if we go late enough, right? I think it was like at 9 o'clock at night or something. I don't know. But we were like, okay, the kids are home in bed. Like, okay, we'll, you know, this is the adult. The adult's going to go watch an animated film. We're like, yeah, we just want less of that like happening. And so I just remember going, watching Rise of the Guardians and being like, this is the coolest thing ever. Because like, it's a bunch of like fairy tale characters, right? Think we know everything, right? About these are stories that we've grown up with and everything. But like, I was telling like Chris before this, like, it is like you take your fairy tale characters and basically make them badass. So like Santa, or again, he's called North. Santa has a Russian accent. He has tattoos and snarky, and he's just fun. And then like Sandy is like this cute little small character who doesn't say anything. There's a kind of like a noise like he makes. It kind of sounds like jingle bells almost. A noise that he makes, right? And all of the characters, right, understand him. And of course, like the audience, we don't. So it's kind of like that dynamic. Easter Bunny, voiced by Hugh Jackman, has an full Australian accent. Also like super cool. He's not like this cute little bunny. He's like Easter Bunny is kind of jacked. Like, it's just funny. I'm like, okay.
It's like Hugh Jackman is in his contract. He has to be, every character animated or not has to be under 10% body fat.
Yeah, there you go.
It's mandated. Really? And my P.T. Barnum, cut. Vascular P.T. Barnum. Like, he needs the vascularity, or what's the point?
The vascularity is crazy. And then you have the Tooth Fairy, and she has like her little like, kind of like minions or whatever, but she kind of like moves like a hummingbird, and it's like, it's just like these really like, this is like a cute character, and they're all like really cool characters. And then you have Jack Frost, who carries his cane, and like cane is what helps him like wield his powers and stuff like that, and he's flying around, and he's just this, again, he's a teen, you know, who folks can't see at first because, you know, there aren't any kids who necessarily believe in him. Like, the guardians know who he is, but kids don't know who he is. And that's actually what adds to the guardian's power, is that, you know, the more kids believe in you, right, the more power you have, the more strength you have. So here comes along, he's always really good at playing a villain, Pitch Black, who is voiced by Jude Law. Again, very good. Like, he's always so good at playing those characters. And so Pitch Black is determined, of course, to take all of the belief, like, he wants to weaken the guardian. So he wants to take, you know, essentially like fill the kids like dreams with like, not dreams, but like nightmares. Like, he is a piece of work. I'm like, first of all, what the kids do to you to like, why do you want to give them all nightmares? It's crazy. But like, yeah, so. So that's his whole mission. And so, of course, like, with adding Jack Frost as like, you know, onto the Guardians, like, the whole time Jack is trying to figure out like where he comes from, what his backstory is. He's trying to find his identity. He finds out that each of the Guardians kind of like has their center. So their center is essentially like their purpose. Like, what is their purpose? And so the whole time he's like trying to figure out who that is, and he's reluctant to become a guardian and stuff because he doesn't feel like he quite fits in. But all the while, like, you know, he wants to be known, right, by the kids. You know, he's constantly creating all of these opportunities like for the kids to, you know, to play games, have fun, especially in the snow. And so it's about really him finding his identity, finding like what makes him him, finding his purpose, and at the same time being recognized, right, by the kids. And eventually, like, I guess, like in the story, Pitch Black kind of takes that strength away from the guardians, right? Getting more and more kids to not believe, right, that each of these fairy tale characters exists. The way in which the film is done, like I said, like when I was sitting there watching the film, a few thoughts came through my head was like, one is just how cool the animation is. There's all these like little details that you notice throughout the film. It's very colorful, very vibrant. You know, it has that, again, the kind of animation that's there. You know, the design is very much like what you would expect if you've seen other DreamWorks animation films. Like, you can kind of picture, you know, what that'll look like. But again, it's all in like all the details and how meticulous it is and how each character has their own like thing. You know, it's a very beautiful looking film. It's also a very like heartwarming film. Again, I went as it, cause I also appreciate animation, and I'm going in like, it just, you know, full grown adult just watching this animated film. And it is still something that very much like resonates, cause we're all people who have needed to find, been wanting to find, you know, what our center is, essentially, you know, what our purpose is, and, you know, really knowing who we are and our identity and how we serve, right, other people, how, what our relation is to like humanity and our community. And so that really, that's something else that really resonated. It was also just like, it's a fun film. It makes, like, again, fairy tale characters just look badass. It was awesome. And I just remember feeling like a kid watching it. I get the sense of that, like, from Rise of the Guardians, from Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But yeah, just like as far as the impact, when I was doing research for this film, technically this was actually a flop. I'll never forgive y'all, by the way, for sleeping on this movie. And
I like how a flop is. It made $300 million
yes,
on $150 million budget,
right?
Which is like, oh, that's not enough. Like, because it's all fake numbers. They're like, oh, you have to make twice the money. I'm like, right. Why don't you just tell us how much the damn thing cost?
No, yeah. Well, because it was projected. So when they first started like screening the film to see how audiences would take it, they, like, it was projected to make like so much money. People were really responding to it in a positive way. So they figured, okay, this is great. You know, we'll release it. We'll make so much more money. And it made way less than what they projected. So then you get media outlets already reporting it as a flop. And so now Peter Ramsey is feeling like, well, they're never going to hire me again because like I couldn't make back like the money that it was supposed to, or I couldn't make the money that it was supposed to. And I'm just like, that's crazy to hear, because I don't think, before doing research for this, I don't think I was aware. I just remember loving the heck out of the film. And then anyone else who mentions Rise of the Guardians, I'm immediately like, oh my God, yes, let's talk about it. Let's geek out about it. Cause it's such a well-made film.
Well, it also has like the expertise of other like legendary people, like cinematography. Roger Deakins was consulting on Roger, the cinematography.
The great.
The visual consultant. Guillermo del Toro was executive producing because he believed in the concept and helped massage that. Like, you're getting all these people who have such unique visions. But that goes back to what made more money than this. Boss Baby worldwide made $525 million.
Why?
Like, just like straight garbage. And then you have something with like a vision that is trying to do something. But that's the frustrating stuff when you see somebody trying to do something and tell a story that means something to them. And then you just see that and you're like, All right.
Right. Like, it boggles the mind, like, what ends up doing well and what crashes. Like, another example, which has nothing to do with Peter Ramsey, but it's the thing that popped into my head just now, was that Scott Pilgrim versus the World was also a box office flop. And every single person, like, and of course, I mean, I don't talk to, you know, millions of people, but like, I do talk to quite a few people. And any time that I've brought up Scott Pilgrim versus the World, people are like, oh my God, let's talk about it. Like, this, it's such a great film. And they also talk, and then the comic book people, the comic book nerds, shout out to y'all, will constantly be like, yeah, the movie was so much better than the comic book. The comic book sucks. Like, and I'm just going, well, why did y'all sleep on this movie? It's crazy. Like, I'm just like, you know, you think, and you never quite know. Like, of course, you can do your projections, you can screen it before audiences, and it just goes to show, like, you just don't know what people are going to respond to, like, in the general audience.
Yeah, like, how did they know that, like, the Dragon movie was going to do so much more than this? Like, Dragon made so much, and Dragon's it's a great example of a DreamWorks movie.
Right.
But, like, it seems like this one was equally as crafted as that was.
Yeah. And then apparently, I think, so in an interview, because he talks about bouncing back from that, it was also, I think, two big films had been out for at least a couple weeks beforehand. Mm. It was like the whatever the new James Bond movie was, and Twilight, I think, or one of a part of the Twilight saga, which I haven't paid attention to.
It'll just bury you.
So it's like, so you didn't have a shot in hell, which is unfortunate because, again, incredible film. Yeah, I just, you know, because of that, like, people were like, after that, thinking about or wondering if we were going to get a sequel to Rise of the Guardians, and that didn't end up happening. I remember hearing that and going, oh my God, I would love a sequel. And then it just never happened, which is a shame. Because I would have loved to see them develop that more. Do they bring in another recruit? You know, like, and, you know, where does the story go from there? Is it still following the same kids? Are we seeing the kids grow older and, like, dealing with that? Or, like, there's, like, so many different avenues that, you know, a sequel could take it, but we will never know. So if you haven't seen Rise of the Guardians, I highly recommend that you go watch it. Unfortunately, it's not on any like streaming services that I've seen. I know that you can rent it through like YouTube and others. I think it's like $4 on YouTube. As far as I know, it's not on any streaming services. You can rent or just go buy the film. Physical media is king. Please go buy it. I would highly recommend for any of those who are watching and listening, it is an animated feature that you can absolutely show to your kids. I would highly recommend it, actually. It's a really heartwarming film, a well-made film. And after this film, Peter Ramsey was recognized as, and again, like, it's a sad thing that it's, you know, even then it's still, we're still accounting firsts. But he was the first African-American to direct an animated feature, which seems crazy to me because it was 2012. But again, you know, I mean, in 2026, we're still looking at first. I just that could be a whole other video or, you know, podcast episode. But, you know, I digress. So moving on to Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, released in 2018. Peter Ramsey was the co-director for Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and it follows Brooklyn teenager Miles Morales, who's bitten by a radioactive spider in the subway and suddenly develops mysterious powers that transform him into the one and only Spider-Man. When he meets Peter Parker, he soon realizes that there are many others who share his special high-flying skills. Miles must now use his newfound talents to battle the evil Kingpin, a hulking madman who can open portals to other universes and pull different versions of Spider-Man into our world. Okay, so when this movie came out, I was high-key obsessed. I'm not even going to say low-key, because that would not be doing my obsession with this film justice. I'm trying to remember how many times I saw it in theaters. I think it was like three or four times. I can't remember.
So there's a clarification I have to ask, Jackie. Did you like this movie?
No, not at all. What do you mean? Not at all.
I can't remember how many times you and I have talked about it. But I mean, also, how many times has everybody watched it? This is one of the single most rewatchable movies of the last decade.
Right. By the way, shout out to Michael Huntone, who thinks that he is the biggest fan of this film. I don't think so. And thank you. Michael, by the way, you have 24 hours to respond.
Shout out to Punches and Popcorn, but no, come on, Mike.
Because we did that. It was over Twitter. We're like, I highly doubt that you're the biggest, because we would go back and forth about that. Who's the biggest fan? And I'm like, absolutely not. I will. Yeah. No, I know this film like the back of my hand.
No it questions will be taken.
For real. Okay. So for those of you who are, I got to say this. For anyone who is not like a big Marvel fan, not a big comic book fan, not a big animated fan, this film is for you. I really don't think that you have to be any one of those to truly appreciate like what this story is about. I mean, there's so many things that this film touches, right? You know, we talked about how Peter Ramsey is very drawn to stories where you're having to find one's identity, one's purpose, one's way in the world. And this is a teenage boy who, again, I mean, regardless of whether or not you're familiar with the Spider-Man films, is very much, again, about finding your purpose in life and adjusting to changes, right? You know, as teens, you know, you go, your body's going through a lot of changes, right? Your mind is going through a lot of things. You're having to deal with so much that is going on at home with those changes. You're also having to deal with that at school and so many other like kids and like trying to fit in, right? Because sticking out would mean that you're being bullied, you're being targeted, like all these different things. So you're constantly dealing with all of that just as a regular teenager. And then you add on like the added layer that is having superhuman abilities. And so he's having to navigate all of this. There's also the fact that, you know, there's now all these other like characters coming into view. So now he's recognizing that there are other people that are like them. So now he is in a way finding people that also understand what he's been through. And so each of them sort of kind of like play as like mentors to him. But there's still that kind of that feeling of like being the other, being the one who hasn't fully embraced their abilities or taken control of like those abilities. So all at the same time, while he's wanting to feel like he belongs, right, to this group of supers, right? Like he's still having a hard time with feeling as though he can fully be accepted.
The Level Up Coffee podcast is now dialed in.
We love coffee and stay connected to every development in the industry, both here in Rochester and worldwide, to bring you our unique perspective on the ever-changing world of coffee.
We're doing regular tastings, reporting on our travels, and trying to hold back tirades about the forces that make the coffee supply chain a neo-colonial mess. Join us on the Lunchador Podcast Network and wherever you get your podcasts, and stay
dialed in.
Or fully be with them, especially in their mission, you know, to stop Kingpin and everything like that. So it's him constantly having to prove himself to himself. You know, he doesn't want to stick out. He's going to the school for gifted students, right? So everyone that he goes to school with is also, right, someone who is seen in our society as extraordinary, right? There's someone who is like a prodigy, someone who's smarter, right? You know, and so like, all like in that case, like he just wants to be seen as normal, and you know, that's proven difficult. But the film does a fantastic job in like weaving all of that. He also has his Black and Puerto Rican like identity, right? And so there's a lot of talks, especially outside of the film, about like what that means, because traditionally too, when we talk about Spider-Man, you know, we're talking about Peter Parker is a white kid, right, like from New York City, like so we're now focused on someone who has a different identity. So there's also other things, I think, more outside of the film, rather than inside the film, but it's again just another like dynamic, right, to throw into the film, and not just throw into the film. I mean, it's part of canon. It's part of comic book lore,
especially since it is such a New York too.
Yes,
and I think the Miles Morales version is so entrenched in. Yeah. You know, Into the Spider-Verse is so entrenched in New York.
Yes, yes, yes.
Like, not to bring this too into current events, but I didn't watch the Super Bowl, but I watched the Bad Bunny performance.
I mean, we all, come on.
Yesterday.
Who didn't watch the Benito Bowl? All right.
But what, like, when we're thinking about representation,
yes.
When we're thinking about Puerto Rican representation, mm-hmm. like, and I see that, and like, I just get emotional thinking about how beautiful of representation that was, because it wasn't one thing, it was everything.
Oh yeah,
it was, you know, the ups, the downs, the, you know, the sexy, the, you know, the, you know, the struggle, and mm-hmm. all the stuff from, you know, culture to community, right. And I think that's what this also accomplishes so well, is that it never loses the fact that this is a real New York story. It's not just Peter Parker lives in New York. Like, this is more of a New York story. The real New York in many ways than any other Spider-Man story ever has been. And that, like, that representation is so present in the story, but it's never force fed. It's so, it just is.
And I'm also thinking too about, I mean, there's moments where, you know, him and his mom, like, they're speaking in Spanish. That's not translated. There's like little bits and pieces here and there. It's not translated. And I think that, you know, of course that's on purpose, because, you know, this is the way that, you know, mother and son, like, they talk to one another, and we don't necessarily need to be. I mean, of course, if you're someone who understands Spanish, then, you know, that's just another, like, a bonus, or like just something that again speaks to that experience. Right. And that there's also the fact that, and again, when you're saying, we were talking about it being a uniquely New York story, I'm also thinking about how there's also too a lot of hip hop, right? Like, that's infused into the score of the, you know, the soundtrack playing in the back. And I mean, Brooklyn being the birthplace of hip hop. And I'm thinking about that scene with him and his uncle, voiced by Mahershala Ali, on when they're going down and they're going into like the subway. And this is where he gets bitten. There's actually a funny like thing that happens, like, well, when he's getting bit, you think that it's this going to be this big thing, and it's literally just him like flicking the spider off of his hand. Like, it's just funny. But like, when he's down there, like, it's a way for him to bond with his uncle. There's also hip hop playing in the, like, he's got his beatbox, and like, or the, not beatbox, what am I, boombox, gosh, I can't talk anymore, his boombox, and he's, you know, he's playing hip hop, and there he's drawing you know, graffiti like on the walls and stuff with his uncle, and like, it's just like this way to bond. It's again underneath Brooklyn being the birthplace of hip-hop, like all of these different things coming together. Also too, just the way, again, obsessed, the way that this film the way that it's animated. There were so many other films afterwards that took that same thing. I know the newest Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles also took that same style. And they made it their own, but they took the same sort of style that you see in Into the Spider-Verse and made it their own. There's other films, you know, that sort of like took that same look, but it looks as though you are literally taking pages from the comic book. Right. So you can see like lines are defined. It's sharper. It you have sharper edges. There's so many things, like it's like you're looking at a moving comic book. And that's what I absolutely appreciate. And I also have to talk about this moment, because this for me just like put the cherry on top, was like, so the What's Up Danger sequence and the leap of faith and taking a leap of faith. So this is when he finally like is more in control of his powers, right? He's starting to take on his purpose. He knows, you know, he's fully embraced his whole identity. And so there's What's Up Danger that's playing in the background. And, you know, he's got his costume. He's like making it into his own, and he's getting ready to join, right, the other you know, Spider-Man or spider people, you know, on their mission to stop Kingpin. And that entire sequence, I just remember like tearing up because like it had to have been like a number of different factors, but like how I became obsessed with films as a kid was very much like the spectacle, and it felt larger than life. And like I felt in that moment, I felt like I was 6 years old again watching Star Wars for the first time. Like that hit me like so hard. And I do, I remember like watching the film the first time in theaters and tearing up because I was like, this is literally like how I became obsessed with films, like in the first place. Like it captured that same moment, and I just felt like I was a 6 year old kid again. And I just adore that. And so when you can do that, like as a director, or for so many people, you know, regardless of what age you are, I think it's just, it speaks so well to the incredible artist, because directors are artists, and that you are. So yeah. Oh, I'm about to get emotional right now. Well, like, it's so good.
I think that's the thing, right? Where it's hard. There's a moment in there for anybody.
Yes.
And not
anyone
everybody.
Anyone can wear the mask.
But it's anybody. Anybody, yes, has a moment in there when you, if you're watching it, really engaging with it, there's a moment in there for you, yeah, that is going to hit you in a way that you didn't expect.
Right. Exactly.
If, yeah, you love the craft of animation, this is one of the single best crafted animated movies ever.
Yeah.
If not the best crafted animated movie ever.
I mean, it won an Oscar. This is what got Peter Ramsey, again, talking about firsts, first African-American to win an Oscar for best animated feature.
And it could not be more deserved, because it's also a revolutionary animated movie. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It changed the game of, yeah, animated movies in,
yeah,
many ways.
Yeah, for sure.
And it also might be the best Spider-Man story
it
ever made.
It is the best Spider-Man movie. It is the best Spider-Man. Argue with your mama. I will go toe-to-toe. This is the hill I will forever die on.
Well, and I think that this speaks to the comic book nerds in our world, the Mike Huntones of the world, if you will.
Uh-huh.
Where...
It's all love. We love Mike over here.
I can very confidently say that the Batman animated series is the best Batman ever.
So good.
And the best Joker ever.
Yeah.
It's hard not to say that this was the best Spider-Man movie ever made, the best Spider-Man story ever told, because it broke so many barriers, mm-hmm, and not the race barriers, not just the race barriers, but that too.
But that too, yes, for sure.
But the crafting and the story,
yeah,
are perfect. Yes. It's just,
it's a perfect film.
Like,
it's hard
not to say amazing things, like the cast alone. But this is where, when you look at some of the other animated movies, you're like, oh, we just jammed as many celebrities in as possible.
Yeah.
Every single person fit the roles, mm-hmm, the casting and all the, yeah, choices, like Liev Schreiber as Kingpin.
Oh my God.
It's not the best Kingpin ever, because that's always going to be Vincent D'Onofrio in the, yeah, new one. Yeah. But, yeah, it's a great Kingpin because it has emotional pathos. It has emotional ties. Mm-hmm. You know, our girl Hailee Steinfeld from Sinners.
Yes, yes.
You know, as in there. And
Shameik Moore. Yeah, Shameik Moore.
Oh, and he's so good.
He does an incredible job.
Jake Johnson, Mahershala Ali. I mean, yeah, the best looking man, like, of the last 20 years. Like,
oh my gosh. But Jake, first of all, Jake Johnson. Oh, speaking of which, also, too, the first Parker.
Yeah.
Thank you. I almost said Peter Pan. I don't know why.
I mean, you know.
But like the first Peter Parker in the film is Chris Pine. So Chris Pine comes back, you know, to feature in another Peter Ramsey film. But then we get Jake Johnson, and the gift that Jake Johnson is as Peter Parker is, I can't imagine anyone else playing.
He's
hilarious.
He's so over it.
Oh my gosh. You know, getting strong. Like, I'm like, just his performance in it is everything. Like, everything. Like, as much as I love, you know, who's playing, you know, who's voicing Miles Morales, I also enjoy like his parents, his uncle, like they're all like heavy hitters.
Because his dad is Brian Tyree Henry, yeah, who's awesome.
Amazing.
And I think he's so dad.
Yeah, oh my gosh.
In this.
Just like, say Say I love you back. Say I love you back. Say I love you. That's a copy.
Luna Lauren Velez, you know, people watch Dexter. That's Detective LaGuerta or Sergeant LaGuerta. You know, like the voice is so identifiably Puerto Rican. And, but it's like a career actor, like who's so good. Yeah. And it's not a huge part, but every part had deepness and richness to it. Minus maybe John Mulaney as Spider Pig, which I'm not sure had depth and other things. But
no,
it was
but it was fun. It was fun. It was a fun.
Nick Cage.
Nick Cage. Oh my gosh. As Spider-Man Noir. Oh my God.
It's all those things. The tonal shifts, the complication. Like, this is
the
why.
The coloring.
So, I want to do the nerd thing for 1 second.
Sure.
And talk about the frames, the frame rates they did. Because this was the thing. It's every so often you see these little things about movies.
Yes.
That bring the magic. And you don't when you don't realize that they've happened. And then you see it after.
Yeah.
When you're talking about that experience of going to the movies.
Yep.
And you are inspired.
Absolutely.
That they started it off at a lower frame rate, and as he became confident and became Spider-Man, it became smoother and higher frame rate.
Oh, I didn't even realize that.
It's a complete choice.
Oh my God.
So they changed the frame rate
watch it again
clearly. Of the movie as he became Spider-Man. When you watch it again, can't not see it.
No, it will be something that I am absolutely like tune into. There's always, like, with every watch, there's always some detail that I notice, and especially like the background. So there is because Donald Glover, Childish Gambino, was someone who had been begging, like, there was this whole campaign for him to be in the Spider-Man because he's that obsessed with the film or with the comic book and the character, and he had been wanting to be it, and of course I think like aged out of it, or you know, there was just like something about that. But like, they're watching, so when he's over his uncle's apartment, they're in the background is playing an episode from Community, but it's the animated, like, so it's like an animated version of Community.
It's so good.
And I'm just like, that little detail right there is just
So the frame rate thing started 12 frames a second, got up to film rate towards the end.
Okay.
So next time you watch it, you're going to see it, and you're just going to be like, you're going to nerd out so hard about it.
Oh, for sure.
It's like, so there's one recently I saw, because he also worked on Castaway, it brought its back up.
Mm.
Castaway, the entire audio on the island was ADR'd.
Wait, what?
All of it was ADR. Every voice, every background, every single thing was ADR'd.
What in the world?
I saw it recently on a video, and these are the things, you know.
Wait, explain ADR.
Okay, so ADR, so if you watch if you think of like the old like martial arts movies where you see the mouths moving and you get the voice at a different cadence, or you hear a voice that doesn't sound like it was filmed where it was filmed. Mm-hmm. Right, you're in a car and you hear it perfectly clearly with no audio in the background, or it's jarring. That's like recorded audio after. It's not recorded in the moment of filming.
Right.
I forget the actual acronym of ADR, but it's recording the audio after. And this movie, so Castaway, you know, the Tom Hanks movie where he's shipwrecked on an island.
Right.
They did every bit of audio after, and it's so perfect that nobody knew. And they did all the work and nobody noticed that it was done because it was done so perfectly. And that they didn't get the credit for like a decade after because of how perfect it was. But that's that thing. Like, you've seen that how many times? Spider-Verse.
Yeah.
And you didn't notice because it's meant not to be noticed. It's meant to be felt. And you feel it, but you didn't know it was there.
My gosh. Okay.
And so, every so often that magic,
yes.
We get to experience that magic. And now as a film nerd and as a director, you're going to see that and you're going to be like, oh, they created a magic with technical choices.
Which is just insane. So, okay. So ADR is automated dialogue replacement. So it's a post-production process where actors re-record dialogue in a quiet studio to replace on-set recordings with better audio quality, fix technical issues, or update lines. It's also known as looping. So this essential technique ensures clear, perfectly synced sound for movies, TV, and games. So that's ADR.
Yeah. And this is also the joy of watching a great movie like Into the Spider-Verse with a director that made choices.
Yeah.
And when the choices work out like these do, all of the choices.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard. There's almost no flaws
in
the movie.
And he talks, too, about, like, because afterwards they had wanted to bring him on as director for Across the Spider-Verse. And this was while they were still making Into the Spider-Verse. And he was just like, it's a very, like, we're all pleased, very pleased with the work. Like, with, you know, with the finished film. But it was a very difficult process. And he talks about like how, especially for animation, I mean, especially when you're going with like a different kind of animation, you know, one that we haven't seen before, there's a lot of talks about, like, for instance, how lighting, you know, hits your character in the morning versus at night, you know, what are the shadows? You know, what are the shadows looking like? You know, what does it, what is the water? Like, how does the water move? Like, there's all these very things that you would normally take for granted. You're having to consider now in animation because it's not something that you've seen before. So now they're having to really create this world and so starting at like the basic levels, because again, they don't have any reference, you know, with what to reference to, like how they light certain things. And so constantly talks about, oh, it's too dark, it's too light, you know, this needs to be changed and everything like that. So it's a very long and difficult process because there's just like so much to review, so many things to consider. So of course, like, I think he likens it to like if you asked a pregnant woman if she, you know, who's having triplets, if she wants to have another kid, she'd throw something at you. So like, so like he says this in an interview and it just made me laugh. But like, I'm like, yeah, it like it had to be, he's like, I don't know if I like have the spoons like to be able to take on that big of a commitment. And so soon, so, but not wanting to, of course, come away from, like, be away from it entirely, he then decides to be an executive producer on Across the Spider-Verse. So he's still involved. It's just not like the day-to-day sort of thing that he had to be as a director. So there's so much. And then, you know, when you're talking about things like, you know, Across the Spider-Verse, you know, there were a lot of conversations too about, and I know this was happening quite a bit, you know, with what's going on with like animators and the people who are designing, you know, for the film and stuff and the just the amount of hours that it takes, right? And so like, you know, when we're talking about Into the Spider-Verse, you know, especially when you're creating something that hasn't been done before, it's a ton of work that people are not aware of, unless of course you're working, you know, on the film. So I just give him and so many of the people, you know, so many of the animators, you know, just all the credit for putting together just an incredible film, an amazing, 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 amazing story. And it's just fun and it's heartwarming. And again, it's like a familiar story, but there's so many layers. So again, if you haven't watched Into the Spider-Verse, if you have Netflix, I know it's on Netflix right now, because I play it on in the background, because of course I play it in the background whenever I'm working on stuff, because I have memorized that film I think at this point. It's one of my comfort movies. So yeah, if you have not watched it, do so. And you don't have to have watched every single Marvel film like you have to do with like every other film from the Marvel Cinematic Universe to understand what's going on. We really don't have to be that. You don't have to be a comic book fan necessarily, or even a superhero fan. It's a great film. It's a heartwarming film, you know, filled with themes of, again, identity, of finding your purpose, of family, finding family, belonging, all of the things, right, that just like make you feel like inspired. And it's
complicated family too.
Yeah,
complicated family, because it's not a soft movie,
right?
But it's not a hard movie. It's a movie that carries some weight with those relationships. And I think that's where great animated movies that kids can love. I don't know if kids can love the things that have no depth. And this isn't just for kids. This is for everybody. Yeah, this is
for everyone, for sure.
But if you were the right kid that saw this, you might see something that might resonate with you. You might not know it then, but something's going to resonate with you.
Oh, yeah. There were so many kids dressed up as Miles Morales for Halloween. Like,
well, they should be.
Yeah.
And it might be, you might figure out something emotionally about how you're acting. Mm-hmm. You might think of your parents differently. You might think of adults differently.
Yeah.
You might think of, hey, you also might learn something about music. You learn something about something. You're learning or loving something because there's so much to love about it.
So
like, you're learning about heartbreak. You're learning about all these things.
Yeah.
And that's also a great lesson. And it's, you're allowed to have depth in your movies that kids can love. You're
Seriously,
allowed to have depth.
You really are. You really are.
And then, you know, shout out to the writing too, because Phil Lord, you know, Lord and Miller are amazing writers.
Yeah.
I do want to shout out their follow on to not this, but they did the Lego Movie, which of course is one of the great, you know, intro, you know, animation movies.
So
but like the one that definitely made me cry sitting in the house during pandemic was Mitchell's Versus the Machines.
Oh.
Like, just, I think they've hit such a beautiful mark. Their writing is great.
Yeah.
But I love that this was driven not by them. It was driven by somebody who knew the culture that brought it so truly and authentically to the screen through amazing effort. And that statement you said about, I'm not sure I can do it again, shows how much went into it. But that's on every frame of the movie.
Yeah.
Is effort and passion, because you can't make this kind of perfect movie without that kind of passion and dedication. You can't.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So Peter Ramsey, again, who's definitely listening to the podcast, please make more movies, because you are absolutely needed. That was actually part of his speech that he made when he won the Oscar. You know, it was to two other filmmakers, you know, he was saying, we need you, keep going. Well, Peter Ramsey, we need you, keep going. So with that, I will absolutely close this out. It's been, again, if you have not watched you know, any of Peter Ramsey's films, I would highly, highly, highly recommend that you do so. An incredible storyteller, an incredible filmmaker, and I really hope we see more from him. But yeah, he absolutely deserves every single one of his flowers, and so I was happy to give those to him tonight, for real. So listeners, I appreciate if you would go ahead and, you know, share comments, you know, about, you know, Peter Ramsey's films. You know, if you've watched Into the Spider-Verse, if you've watched Rise of the Guardians, I would love to see your comments. You know, make sure you rate this episode 5 stars. And if you haven't already hit that subscribe button, whether you're listening or you're watching on YouTube, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. And also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Threads. You can also visit us at ourvoicesproject.com and sign up for our newsletter for more information about what we do. We'll be back with more episodes every Thursday with old and newly released movies that center Black, Brown, and Indigenous folks, general movie news, and interviews with film festival programmers and curators, film critics, and of course, fellow filmmakers. Next week continues our series on Black filmmakers, their stories and contributions to cinema. We're handing flowers to filmmakers that we feel you should be talking about, some of which you may have heard, some of which you may have not. Either way, you won't know until the show premieres, so make sure that you subscribe. Again, this has been Jackie McGriff, your host for this episode of Representation in Cinema. As always, thank you again for listening.